Hello and welcome to the ninth episode of the Hope Illuminated podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention and mental health promotion, where we live, learn, and work. I am your host, Dr. Sally Spencer-Thomas, and I'm on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we are joined by international experts to inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I'm so grateful you are here. Today's topic is one near and dear to my heart, and it's about how peer support is such a critical link in the chain of survival when we're talking about resilience, mental health promotion, and suicide prevention. And I have probably definitely one of the top international experts on this topic with us today, Eduardo Vega, and he's going to share with us a number of things that I hope we can talk about today. One is, like, what do we mean by peer specialists? In some circles, we call them peer specialists. In other circles, people prefer the term peer support. What are their roles as advocates and liaisons? How does it actually work in different types of settings, whether that's in a addiction recovery setting or a workplace setting or a community mental health setting? How do they help us promote resources? How do we help them have really effective peer-to-peer conversations and help them work with us to advocate for changes in systems and in mental health services? I know one of the questions that comes up a lot in my work with in workplaces that I hope Eduardo is going to be able to help us figure out today is, what is the selection process for the best type of peer support for the culture? Is it a self-selection process? Is it a peer nomination process? Is it a leadership nomination process? How do we figure out who's going to have the best empathy skills, the best surveillance skills for noticing these kinds of changes, who's going to have the best credibility with their peers and so forth? Once we have our peer specialists identified, how do we train them? And how does this training and supervision process go forward so that everybody is continually evolving in their ability to be the most effective peer support possible? And then I also get a lot of questions I'm hoping Eduardo can address today about documentation and evaluation. How do we know that this is working? How do we know it's not harming anybody, including the peer specialists themselves? What should we be documenting, if anything? What do we need to protect ourselves legally, or what should we not be documenting? And how do we know when those boundaries of exceed a peer specialist skills, and how do they know when to refer to mental health services, other types of mental health services? So that's what I'm hoping we're talking about today. And now I have a deep privilege of bringing one of my dearest friends and co-conspirators on the planet, Eduardo Vega, to this podcast. I have deeply admired Eduardo's work for a very long time, and I would say he is one of the people in my life who has shaped my thinking, challenged my viewpoints, challenged my perspective on so many things, probably more than any other colleague I have. He's very, very smart, and he's always pushing the boundaries for us, which I really appreciate. We have been able to do a number of really cool things together all over the world at different conferences and work together on some really important initiatives like United Suicide Survivors International. Today, Eduardo is the CEO of Dignity Recovery Action International. It's a consulting and technical assistance collective focused on social change, social justice, and behavioral health systems, transformed by lived experience. You've heard me talk about this before, the importance of lived experience or lived experience of people who've been there. He's an internationally recognized thought leader in the recovery-oriented program and policy area, consumer empowerment, stigma and discrimination, and men's health and suicide prevention. He is definitely a preeminent change agent and innovator, always on the forefront on many different areas. Previously, he was the president and CEO of Mental Health Association of San Francisco. He's also been the director and principal investigator for the Center for Dignity, Recovery, and Empowerment and he's been the chief of the Division of Empowerment and Advocacy for the Los Angeles County Department of Mental Health, one of the world's largest public mental health authorities. He has worked with stakeholders and consumer groups and government agencies throughout the world, Japan, Netherlands, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Europe, Fiji, Latin America, all over the place he's been. And one of the cool things he invited me to partake with him is this National Destination Dignity Project, which part of it results in a large march of mental health advocates, which is just so inspiring. I talk about it all the time. He and I also serve on a couple of boards together, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. We work together with the U.S. National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention. And through that work, he did probably one of the most important things in the suicide prevention world in its history, which was help create this document called The Way Forward, which gave people with lived experience a chance to voice their opinions on how we can improve our mental health services, our programming, our policy, and our research. So without further ado, let me introduce my friend and coworker and colleague and co-conspirator, Mr. Eduardo Vega. Eduardo, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, and Sally. It continues to be an honor and a privilege, and really significant to me just to be able to work with you and know you and be inspired by your passion and energy in this area as well.
Thank you
for the kudos, and it sounds like a lot in retrospect. It's funny because now I sort of find myself at this point of looking at a lot that I've done that has been done, et cetera, and kind of trying to sort of distill things down to some of the essence of messages that I think haven't been heard enough, strategies and things that we need to see kind of go to the next level. And fortunately, I get to work on that in several different places in the world and stuff like that. But for today, you had some very pointed question specifically about peer support and peer specialists. Is that right?
Yeah, that's kind of where I know we can talk about a lot of things. And I also want to warn my listeners, Eduardo and I are like brother and sister. Sometimes he really challenges my thinking, and we might get into a little bit of debate, but it's okay. We're going to be okay. It works well for us. I know we can talk about a lot of things, and we can talk about things all day, as we often do. But yeah, what I really want you to focus on is the importance of peer support and peer specialists in a number of different areas and a number of distant systems. But before we get there, can you just share with the listeners who come from all walks, all types of places and spaces, all age groups, could you share with them a little bit about your backstory, about how you got into this space, especially about how, what, if any, role peer support played in your recovery and your lived experience?
Yeah, well, it's a very good question. And I think, you know, the probably the most salient thing for people to know, the most significant thing for people to know, is that I'm a person who lives with a mental health condition that I have since childhood, and, you know, perhaps a couple of different ones, depending on sort of how you approach things diagnostically. Also, I'm a survivor of two suicide attempts in my youth, one when I was about 18 and another when I was in college, about 22. This is really important to me, and I got really active in kind of connecting the dots between both peer support and mental health and suicide prevention over time, partially because of my personal story and my experience. So a couple of those experiences that I think of as really formative go back to the times when I was in the most intense crisis. Again, you know, two times I took action to kill myself. And I want to point out also that I'm going to use some terms people may not be accustomed to hearing. I really, part of my advocacy and my approach to things is that we need to be talking about suicide, crisis, psychiatric distress in a really different way than we have been, and that will make a difference in and of itself. So I might use some terms people are not familiar with, but as an example, I'll talk about things like, suicidal intensity or, you know, emotional distress or psychiatric distress. something different from the traditional terms we hear in mental health and suicide prevention, which kind of go to this kind of clinical vocabulary. I really like to focus on the sort of phenomenology of distress and anxiety and mental illness, because I think that's where we get to really understanding that this is the human experience. It's not about people who are specifically flawed or people who are different in some fundamental way from other human beings. However,
that's really
of course,
good. I just wanted to share your introduction of that term, suicidal intensity, has really opened up a lot of conversations because it does take into account not just the thought processes or the feelings, but kind of the whole body experience. So I'm really grateful for you to introduce that term because I think it broadens people's perspective of what that experience is like for people going through it.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's some people who have done a really great job about kind of detailing that and stuff like that. I'm thinking about our friend Craig Miller, who wrote this book, This Is How It Feels, and some others. So this this experience, you know, is really, it is, most of us experience it as physiological, emotional, physical. It's not simply
even
a kind
spiritual,
of
spiritual, right?
And definitely spiritual. And I think it actually is really an important thing that we don't talk about enough is that for a lot of people, these things that are, you know, have been kind of considered suicide and sort of fundamentally bad and even perhaps morally wrong end up being really important change periods in their lives, in their spiritual growth, you might say. And I say this as somebody who's agnostic, I'm a humanist, but I do believe that, you know, our personal growth, our spiritual growth, nonetheless, goes through and can really be amplified through this. Now, this is not true of everybody, but most people who know are familiar with people who have gone through different types of recovery, whether it's from an addiction or something else, are aware of this concept of kind of hitting bottom, and that in a certain sense, you got to hit that bottom, whatever it is for you, to get to this transformational change in your life. So for me, that happened when I was a young person, you know, and although these two suicide attempts were kind of in the mix of that, you know, you could say that they represented the apex of that crisis. I think it's more important to just think that, like, they were important moments in my growth as a person. So I had experienced a lot of addiction, sort of self-medicated a lot in high school, partly to mitigate my my condition, which is now typically called bipolar 2, and got to a point of very serious drug addiction, and it was at a point in which I felt, you know, this what they call in the some people call incomprehensible demoralization, but, you know, was in any case a point where
can you say
I
that
felt
again?
That
I couldn't understand you. What do some people call it?
Incomprehensible demoralization is the term that people use in the addictions recovery movement. And I was just thinking about that recently, how what a powerful term that is, because what it meant was that in addition to all the emotion that I was feeling, I truly on a deep fundamental level felt that there was that my existence was, you know, was in itself a worse than valueless thing. It was like something that I needed to be rid of, really. And that, but after this attempt, in which it was a serious attempt with a gun and stuff like that, that failed, I felt like I have to try another way. And so that was the beginning of my recovery from addiction at that time, again, at about age 19, I guess it was, actually. And that propelled me to another phase of my life where it really started to grow in a different way. And at the on the other side of that, I went through a lot of transition. I went through a recovery program, et cetera. I ended up being able to go back to college, which I had to leave because of my addictions and other things. And slowly started to make my way back to, the life that seemed more desirable for me. And for a while that really took. And then a few years later, I was clean and sober off of drugs and alcohol. But my mental health condition, as you call it, as we call it, or, my experience kind of got to this point again of cycling intensity that I experience, which actually still recurs relatively frequently. But at a point in which also it felt completely unbearable. So we talk about this in suicide sometimes about this feeling of like unbearable emotion, like you can't contain the emotion. The distress of it within you is at such a level that you feel that you want to escape from yourself, that you need to escape from yourself. So, as we go along, I'll also sort of introduce some terms from dialectical behavioral therapy and other things like that that seem relevant to me now. But the point is that in the combination of these different types of things, I attempted suicide again. Again, luckily, was not die, even though, perhaps I should have, technically speaking. But at the other side of that attempt, I actually was still intending to kill myself. And a couple of things happened then that really turned things around for me. So one of them was I had been fired from my job. I had been kicked out of school, which used to happen if you attempted suicide. People would do things like this and stop talking to you. That still happens, actually. My landlord offered me a job working with some seriously disabled kids, profoundly disabled. And I was still planning at this time to kill myself, but I knew I needed to kind of sort of rearrange things a little bit. So I took this job working with people who were really significantly, as I said, disabled, and I really started to connect with them. And I got the sense that I could make a difference in somebody else's life. And whatever the limits of that are, so to speak, it really gave me a different perspective on my humanity, so to speak, on my role in the world or the universe, if you will, as one in which, notwithstanding anything else, I still could make a difference to the positive. Even if I hated myself, even if I thought I was pretty worthless, even if I had these, awful feelings and moments, and even if, in a certain sense, if I failed in all of my life ambitions, there are other people who are suffering more, who had a harder way in life. I could put some energy towards making a difference for others. So in a certain sense, this kind of goes to what we talk about, which is the helper principle, which is actually a key factor in the element of peer support. But also plays into all these other things that people do in the world and to a large degree in the helping profession. That's to say, as most people know, helping others helps you too. Right? We know that this experience of connecting with another, of contributing to somebody, sometimes just even opening the door for somebody when they got their arms full of groceries, it gives you a feeling of meaning and connection and a little more positive energy behind your role in the world, right?
Yeah, it's so powerful. I think that's why, there's the emerging opportunities for volunteerism among people with mental health conditions, because it's so healing when we connect to something larger than ourselves. When we help other people, we get this, I don't know what kind of hormonal release we get, endorphins, I think. But we just start to feel real a lot better, and it helps us kind of put things into perspective. I love that. I'm going to find some additional resources on that helper principle, because I think it's key to the how and why peer support works.
Yes, and a little bit of a plug. So I'm working on a book about this, actually, called Help, the Principle of actually, I don't have the full title, but it's something like Help, I Need to Help Somebody. And it sort of explores this kind of concept in a more general way. And one of the things that's important to realize about the helper principle is that there is also, you know, if you think about it, there's a kind of an egoistic part of this, right? And we must be aware of it and be conscious of it, because it also plays into, it has some negative effects, particularly as a person, or when people experience things on the helped, on the user side of human services and stuff like that. There is a possibility that the benefit that the other people are getting, that the helpers are getting, outweighs actually the benefit that they're providing to the people who need help. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Can you say more about that?
Well, it's a you know, as an example, this is, you know, this can come really clear. So here's, you know, a lot of times people get into human service professions or helping professions, you know, really good intentions, and certainly no desire to kind of dominate or subjugate or demean or dehumanize anybody else. But what happens at the end of the day a lot of times is that the counselors go home, they're feeling pretty good. And, you know, and I'm speaking as somebody who worked in the system for many, many years too. And we'll go out to the bars and we feel good about ourselves, and we go home and I talk to our neighbors and they say, you're doing such great stuff, I can't believe you're such a good person, et cetera. But the clients that we're working with, they may not be getting all that better. We may be kind of helping them get through day to day. We may, through our services, ultimately be making a long-term difference. But there is this other possibility too, which is that in serving our own sort of impulse and our eliminatory impulse that I talked about, the helper and desire to help, that we're not really, really contributing to other people in a certain way, in the way that we can. And part of this is a very technical aspect to this. I know it sounds a little abstract right now, is if you think about the aspect of disempowerment, right? So this is something that plays out, and that many, many consumer movements, user movements, both in disabilities and in other things, have really, really helped on, kind of focused on, which is that if you do too much for me, or things that you think are probably reasonable to do for me, then ultimately you may be taking away from me the ability to develop my confidence, to develop my ability to do things myself, and to get to that next level of dignity and self-empowerment and agency that I need as a human being in my recovery. I can give you a very classic example that we've seen in mental health and social service systems, where somebody with a psychiatric disability might be in a program, and then they have this ability to kind of go to a job or something like that. And the counselors or the managers or the staff will say, Mary's got a job, that's great. She's got to go across town. Who's going to drive her across town? And somebody will say, oh, we can't drive her, or we'll have to get a van or something like this. And eventually maybe they'll figure it out and they'll sort of drive Mary to this position that she's got, you know, across town. Now, somebody might say, well, why can't Mary go across town? Is there some reason that Mary couldn't go across town? She doesn't have any mobility issues. But the prevailing understanding of these systems has been, these are people who are fragile and vulnerable and disabled. And so you would hear things like this, like, well, she would get lost, or, you know, what if she had an incident on the bus, or blah, blah, blah. you know, and then some people say, no way, there's no way Mary could possibly do that. She couldn't do that. We know Mary. More and more then, as we start to think about this aspect of what came to be called psychiatric rehabilitation, and then more sort of specifically around empowerment and the recovery movement, you start to really see, okay, hey, look, maybe Mary can't do this right now today, but rather than take away the learning opportunity for her to get there, and why don't we, you know, sort of support her in learning and becoming more independent in and of herself? So it goes back to the basic thing: you do too much for people, then not only do you support the idea that they can't do more, you might actually subtly be telling them in their minds you really can't do more. You shouldn't aspire to this. You are a person who, you know, is fundamentally unable to do some basic things.
Have you, in your journey, experienced this, even by well-intended folks, either the helper principle, where you're definitely getting helped from helping other people, or this experience of disempowerment where people are making assumptions about your ability to do whatever it is that they were expecting you to do?
Yes, very definitely. And in fact, this plays out a lot when you start to work in systems as somebody who's disclosed as having a condition, as somebody who's disclosed as a suicide attempt survivor, is that people look at you and think about you a little bit differently. One of the things that I remember that was the most salient to me, or the way that really stood out to me when I was a young person, and I had met with some people at this mental health institution, and my case manager and stuff, then they said, you know, well, what do you want to do? What do you want to see in the long term? And I said, well, I want to direct theater in New York. And so my case manager, my therapist, was kind of looked at me with like kind of like a nice, like kind of crinkly eye, like, oh, you're so cute kind of look, and said,
right.
Well, maybe we should
go dream
big. Why don't you think about
Eduardo.
Working at what? Yeah. And so, and then what she said is, well, maybe you could work at McDonald's.
Oh, no.
And so, again, the intention here on her side was to say, hey, you could do something, but don't think big. Don't have these dreams that might apply to other people, but wouldn't apply to a person like you, right? Right, and those sort of subtle things that we kind of call microaggressions in the form of stigma really pervade a lot of the helping professions in a lot of ways. I just want to get back, though, for a second to say I think this is – I'm really glad to be able to talk about this, the complexity of this helper principle, because there's a lot of positive to it too. And one of the things – one of the ways that it really makes a difference is when people who have been in the help role – that's to say, people who have been on the receiving end of help then have the ability to give help themselves. This can be really transformative in people's lives, and I've seen it many, many places in many, many ways. At the end of the day, we are a people, our species. We need to give to others, and when people kind of get into this role where their whole identity is built around being a source of problem or being someone to whom things are brought, help is brought, resources are brought, this sort of thing, you know. Sometimes the police are brought, other things, like always on the opposite end. What that underscores is this idea that you don't really have anything to contribute, right? You are a taker, you're not a contributor. In a lot of places, this talk about sort of the psychiatric survivor term as an example. One of the microaggressions, as they say, these kind of stigmatizing things that exist within the system that people have experienced a lot, is this idea that, you know, we don't think badly about you. You're fine, and you know, maybe we even really like you, but on a basic level, we don't support the the notion that you have something distinctively valuable to contribute to your society. And then
I also see the helper principle play out, not necessarily when they have a sense that they're a social problem, but maybe in the sense that they have gone through something so difficult that they don't understand why they had to go through it. Whether that's, you know, for me, in my world, it's often around suicide loss. And by helping others, it somehow helps them make meaning out of this very difficult transition in a way that they are better situated, better able to provide empathy and compassion to people who other people have no idea what to say. And that helps them in their grieving process. So it's slightly different from that kind of where they're coming from with their, you know, quote-unquote brokenness into feeling like they're contributing. But it's a similar pathway, I think, of kind of transforming that into the betterment of the common good.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, really, I think we really see coming forward in the scheme of peer support in general, on the most basic fundamental level is, you know, that when it comes down to making a difference and connecting with and supporting somebody else who's been through or going through a lot of personal suffering or distress, somebody else who's been there can do that in a way that's unique to somebody that hasn't. That's not to say that clinical services or psychotherapy, things like that, can't help people. But I can tell you one thing, which is, again, kind of tracking back to my story and my journey. The other thing that made a big difference when I was, in this really, really awful time, you know, in college, was that I went to a meeting and I saw a guy, and he had red slashes on his wrist, both his wrists. Actually, pretty bad. They were healing scars, but he had, you know, obviously really done a job on his wrist in a suicide attempt. And I had met a lot of people, and at that time I was interfacing with a psychologist and a psychiatrist and some other people and stuff like that. But the one person I really, really wanted to talk to was him. And I wanted to say, I wanted to hear what was it like for you, you know? How did you get through it? How are you dealing with it now? I was always a fan of psychology. I still, you know, think highly of a lot of psychotherapists, et cetera. But the one thing that I knew was that I felt very, very alone. And no therapist's office is going to take that away from me in the sense of making me feel that, know that there are other people who are going through this as well.
Oh, that's so important. And I just want to repeat it because I think it's really, it's a paradigm shift that's on its way. We haven't quite reached it yet. But there has been so much fear. Oh, we can't put, you know, quote unquote, those people together because they will just trigger each other and they will just learn from each other and it's going to be contagious and blah, 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 blah. And all of this fear. Meanwhile, you ask people who've lived through it, what's most helpful to you? And they'll say what you just said. I want to know how other people got through it. I want to know how it's going for them. I want to know if somebody who's shared my level of despair. And connect with them as a partner in my healing journey. And I think we're starting to make incremental movement in that area, but I think fear is still the overriding sense. So I'm so glad you brought that up. Eduardo, thank you so much for sharing your personal story. I'm sure the pieces will continue to come up. I learned something new about you every time we talk. I mean, we've had a lot of long conversations, and so thank you for continuing to share that with me. I want to shift the conversation a little bit now to some of the science. I know from your work at the center, you've been connected to some of the preeminent researchers around stigma and some of these other pieces. I wonder if you could share a little bit more about some of the science behind why peer support is so effective.
Yeah, I definitely can. I think there is a lot out there going back, you know, many years in terms of the research around peer support and its success and how what we call peer-run programs or peer support programs and peer specialists, you know, really do contribute something unique to others, you know, in the mental health field specifically. So for people, for your listeners who might be interested in finding some of that research, I would direct them to the research of Mark Salzer, Dr. Mark Salzer at Temple University, formerly at University of Pennsylvania, Larry Davidson at Yale, and Judith Cook at University of Chicago. All three of them have built a very extensive body of work specifically in sort of the efficacy and the delivery and the success of peer support services. So there is also then this area, you know, really around stigma and stigma change. And so for those purposes, I would really encourage people to look up at the work of Dr. Patrick Corrigan, one of my mentors and a person with the lived experience of mental health conditions himself, who has really helped build this evidence base, not only about stigma, discrimination, peer support, and the experiential aspects of mental illness, but is also one of the people sort of leading a movement of researchers who themselves have lived experience, as I've come to call it, lived expertise.
Oh, that's so cool. Can you actually slow down and talk about that a little more? That's the first time I've heard that. So he's cultivating a cadre of researchers who are open also about their lived experience, and that is informing the questions they ask in the process of research. How is that coming together?
Well, you know, Pat has been somebody championing the engagement of lived experience in research, in the social sciences research, specifically in psychological research, et cetera, for many years. And so he's sort of done this in a somewhat informal sense, but a very proactive sense, by recruiting people who bring their lived experience and who are not who are encouraged to include their lived experience as part of what they're bringing to the table. Now, obviously,
which is a very important distinction to make, right? Because people with lived experience have always been researchers, clinicians, policymakers,
sure,
and so forth. They just haven't been out. And sometimes I think maybe in their fear of being judged, they might even they would ask very, very different questions or behave very differently in a protective way, maybe in a defensive way, perhaps, than they would if they're disclosed and supported for being disclosed.
Yeah, it's very different. So, you know, years ago at the center, you know, we came up with this term lived expertise. And that was kind of the way that I like to sort of think about having your lived experience. So everybody has their lived experience, and you might have a lived experience of, you know, a psychiatric condition or anxiety condition or something like that. And if you disclose about that, or if you're willing and able to use that, you could make a difference by telling your story. Lived expertise kind of takes that to the next level, where you're somebody who has a functional role or a service role or a research role or something else, where you're bringing that experience, like you, Sally, and some of our colleagues, bring that experience as a person who's lived with a mental health condition or a person who knows somebody well or a family member, something like that. Bring that into a functional role that kind of builds a body of professional skills and builds upon things like, it might be research, it might be program development, it might be training, this sort of thing. You're bringing that into your work, so that's lived expertise, as we've come to call it. And then the kind of the one thing, you know, sort of to bridge over that I think is really important, getting back to your point about stigma and fear kind of and its pervasive quality within suicide prevention, is something that, you know, we've talked about a lot and I have with others, which is that a lot of this learning around peer support, peer specialist, peer-driven programs, this has been happening for many years in mental health. There's peer support is an evidence-based practice, according to the federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. There's lots of research on that in the public mental health system, and then to a lesser degree in private services and stuff like that. However, there's been a huge disconnect and a very limited crossover of this knowledge, of this engagement of lived experience in the suicide prevention world on the technical level. So it goes back to some of what you were saying. Yeah, I mean, until a few years ago, people were actively discouraging people from even talking to each other. And the concept that somebody who has been suicidal could help somebody else who is suicidal was one that was greeted with skepticism, I think, at best, and in some places even like a lot of alarm. And this is really, in a certain sense, it's counterintuitive if you haven't been in the mix of suicidology for a while. It doesn't necessarily, but it relates to issues of contagion. And I think on the broadest level, it really relates to this bigger stigma and sort of social fear of suicide, and to some degree, a kind of a moral judgment around people who think about or take action to kill themselves.
Mm-hmm. So we still have work to do.
There's a lot to do. Now, the good thing is, you know, things are changing. And, you know, both, you know, the value of, you know, people who've survived suicide, you know, people who are bereaved by suicide, their ability to help others and to contribute to making a difference, that has really come forward, you know, through a lot of great activism on behalf of people like yourself and many others going back many years. They're starting to have more of a connection to the value of peer support in preventing somebody from killing themselves, dealing in it, and managing, you know, distress and intensity and this sort of thing. And there's a couple of ways I could kind of approach that, but I guess I would suggest that, you know, at least on the sort of program level, there are a few different things that have happened. We developed a peer support program at MHA that was entirely driven by people who themselves were experiencing suicidal thoughts or feelings. We got great results out of that. There was a project where peer specialists were trained in a combination of suicide prevention and also peer support for people in crisis out of University of Michigan. Dr. DeQuincy Lazine, who I think has been on your show, and myself also kind of consulted on that. And then we've had this sort of developing interest and systems buy-in around what we call peer respite in the mental health world. That's to say, crisis level or sub-crisis, you might say, sub-acute if you're in that medical world, sub-acute services for people who need something, a place to go, something different, something intensive based on what they're experiencing, that is different from an alternative to psychiatric hospitalization.
Right.
And also alternative to community-based crisis programs, which, though they can be very valuable, don't have this peer aspect built into them.
Excellent.
So those are starting to develop. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that right now, that's an area in which if you talk to people who have who are themselves or who have recurring thoughts and feelings of suicide, and I know this because people call me or talk to me or write to me when they're having really bad times. If you ask people what they want, that's what they want. We don't want to go to a hospital and have our clothes taken away and be put in a room and, you know, given food and lots of like daytime activities to do. A lot of people don't. Some people find comfort in that. I just want to point that out. But most people, and I've actually had people tell me, I will kill myself before I will go back to a psychiatric hospital.
Mm-hmm.
What most people want is they want to be somewhere where, or connect with somebody who can relate to what they're going through, help them move through this, you know, the most intense time in an environment that feels human and warm and supportive.
And I also think another component of that, Eduardo, might be that there are people at different parts of the journey. So a lot of times in inpatient psychiatric, everybody's kind of really struggling, right? You can find hope there, but you're more likely to find hope in someone who's maybe a little farther down the path in their recovery journey, who has some lessons learned, who could maybe offer you that roadmap or at least a direction out of your despair. So I know a lot of the peer support, peer recovery programs are continuously advocating that, you know, peers continue in their self-care and in their mental wellness so they can be the best advocates for health for the people that they're helping. Can you speak to that just a little bit? And then I'm going to have you turn to your, like, main takeaways.
No, that's a really good point. So, you know, if you think about things that are like really, that really make a difference to others, you know, seeing somebody who's been where you are and who's further down in their recovery or who's come through things. And I mean, I've worked with people and when I hear about the things that they've been through and just recently even on a training, like people, you know, years and years of homelessness, you know, gang rapes, terrible addiction, worst kind of thing. And then you see these people who are like, you know, really, you know, taking charge of their lives in a different way, you know, working to help others and make a difference. That's the kind of thing that really, really turns on a light bulb for somebody who feels very isolated and alone, you know, even if they're in a place where, you know, supposedly they're going through healing, but they're not exposed to the healing. And that is really one of the things that seems really, really crucial, which is that, you know, many, many people live with mental health conditions. A lot of people struggle with suicide, thoughts and feelings of suicide. A good portion of them, and I would say probably most of them, we will never hear from. My hope is to change that a bit. But one thing that we do know is that this, somebody who's been where you are but is further down the road can help you a lot more than somebody who, you know, is kind of looking at it from afar, so to speak, I think. And this ability that people have to kind of walk along with others, even in these things that a lot of people, frankly, feel very fearful about, makes a huge difference. So I don't know if that was an
great
answer to your question or if I skipped ahead. Sorry.
Nope, you did great. So do you have any, like, really pragmatic takeaways for folks if they are interested in starting some kind of peer support program in their workplace? You know, I work with the firefighters and the construction guys, and they are finding this as a huge, huge link in between, you know, these kind of white-knuckling situations where they're just trying to get through on their own and the daunting task of going to see a professional. They are cultivating these peer support programs within industry, also within faith communities. This is another place where different types of peers are coming together in church basements, whether that's men's groups or youth groups where they're talking openly and honestly about what they're going through and are really getting trained in empathic listening and all of these kinds of things. In all these various systems and all these various circumstances, are there some commonalities, some takeaways that people should be considering in selection, training, you know, any legal issues that people should be worried about, anything like that? You can give us those takeaways for people who want to do more in this space.
Well, I think the first thing, you know, kind of, The big thing that I wanted to, you reminded me of, is this issue around legal liability, culpability around other people's suicides. I'm willing to say two things about that. One is I think it's a huge red herring that actually is kind of covering for a lot of social stigma and fear around just the issue of suicide in general, how to deal with it, and really, I think, the social fear of death in various ways. But the other is that even if that's the case, and even insofar as there is that prevailing atmosphere, which you see in clinical services where people say, you can't talk about that, or if they talk about that, you have to refer them to somebody else, something like that. That really works against this, you know, this basic human experience and the ability of people to humanly connect with each other. Now, some people can't do that, and I just feel like it's very important to say what a lot of us have experienced is that a lot of people, you don't talk about wanting to kill yourself or wanting to die with your average person or perhaps your mother or this kind of thing, because they are not able to connect with that. Their level of fear is too high. And this actually is even true around therapists and stuff like that. So, so meeting and connecting with people in the helping professions who are willing, you know, and feel equipped to talk about suicide and suicidal intensity is really important. Meeting and having the ability to connect with peers who can do that is also really important. And then thirdly, I think the other thing is about this kind of big issue is that it requires courage. And I think that is what I would ask that your listeners think about, which is if you're going to move in this direction, if you're willing to take this challenge of really making a difference and doing something new as you are, then you need to have some courage to face up to a lot of the fears and the preconceptions that are out there related to this subject. So
great.
The final thing I think is that, you know, just on the technical level, there are a range of things that I would encourage people to do. Definitely think about getting people, you know, trained in, you know, good active listening skills, person-centered active listening, maybe motivational interviewing. And also, you know, there's some really good trainings for people, you know, to talk to people who are experiencing suicidal intensity. I think ASSIST is pretty good overall. And then, you know, connecting with each other, connecting with you. Of course, you know, people can look me up too if they're interested in some of the technical aspects of how to develop new programs, et cetera. But really this, we have to keep this sort of movement going, and people who are willing to jump in and, you know, get on the bus are going to find that there's a whole lot of people out there who want your help, who need your help, who need change in this direction. And that's the way that we're going to see a change in suicide and suicide attempts. And in the number of deaths that we see in the States all the time now. So,
I truly, truly, truly believe that in the deepest part, that if we can figure this piece out, we will not only drop deaths, we will improve quality of life for so many people. All right, so this has been awesome, Eduardo. Thank you so much. I have a number of themes I just want to bring forward and to also reassure the listeners that certain types of resources that we've talked about will be on the program show notes. One of the pieces that, you know, at the top you talked about was your lived experience story and how that has informed kind of shaping how we think about doing suicide prevention moving forward, from even just the basic, the words that we use. This idea of suicidal intensity can really shift our understanding of that human experience. So on the show notes, I will have the Way Forward documents. I will have Craig Miller's book, This Is How It Feels. I'll also put your Huffington Post article that you wrote. I can't remember the title exactly, but the most important thing that people in suicide prevention are not talking about was kind of the gist, and it's really about the transformational nature sometimes of suicidal experiences. I'm going to dig deeper into this term, incomprehensible demoralization. It's a lot of syllables, but it's a very important concept. When we think about, you know, trying to avoid or escape, you know, I need to get rid of my own existence. You know, there's somebody coming to kill me, and it's me, and how deeply demoralizing that must be. On the flip side, we've talked quite a bit about making meaning and how important it is to connect with something larger than yourself. And one of the additional resources I'll put on the show notes is this a program called Project Helping or Kind Hub. They're both related to the same organization that helps people who are experiencing mental health conditions connect to volunteer work that connects them to other causes. But most importantly, it connects them to one another. Everybody doing the volunteer work is in some way feeling alone in their challenge by mental health problems. And they get together and they, you know, clean parks and they serve soup and they tutor kids. And there's quite a bit of healing and connection that happens there. Love this idea of helper principle. We talked about that quite a bit, about how the helper is often helped even more than the helpee. And sometimes that could actually be to the detriment. So we have to be mindful of that. And, of course, we will look forward to your book as soon as you have anything related to that ready to share. Just let me know. We have to be mindful about this idea of disempowerment, that sometimes if we come too enthusiastically into a situation where we're helping others, we subtly and sometimes not so subtly tell them that they are not able to do it for themselves. Another piece that I think is sadly inherent in our own profession are these microaggressions, statements that we say that convince people that they're not worthy, or other things that we do, you know, maybe even coming from a place of being well-intentioned, that add to the problem. Love this idea of having your identity shift from this idea of being broken or suffering or social problem to social contributor. And when we can get people in that space of taking those personal lessons that were learned to help others, that profound shift in identity, it can be very, very sticky. You talked about in your own experience going through mental health services, this this feeling of, yeah, I didn't want to do the, you know, the coloring book activities or talk to the psychiatrist or whatever. I felt so alone. I just wanted to connect with someone else who had that similar experience as I did, and how the research really does bear that out. So I'll put some of the folks from Temple, Yale, and University of Chicago's research there, as well as Patrick Corrigan's work, which has been so fundamental. I've got a little bit of background noise there. I don't know if somebody's got something going on, but I'd love to talk to you more about the definition of lived expertise versus lived experience. I think we need to kind of operationalize that a little bit more and give people the pathway on how to turn their lived experience into lived expertise so they're contributing very strategically, not just through their storytelling. And then a ton of really good things that you got us to think about in terms of building a peer support program. The wide range of services that we can provide, from, you know, one-to-one liaison and listening skills to a more formal group like you had at Mental Health Association at San Francisco, respite care where people could drop in and get support instead of going to the hospital. Very important, you talked about the fears that we have around doing this, whether it's legal liability or feeling like we're in over our heads, and it's really the fear that is getting in us in the way of people doing the right thing. So I will reiterate what you said about being bold and getting on the bus, doing all of the technical pieces to help make your peer support efforts most successful, whether that's training, supervision, selection, and so forth. So, wow, I know pages and pages of ideas and notes here, Eduardo. What are your final thoughts as we go into our closing?
My final thoughts. There's a lot of people out there right now who are feeling desperate, who are feeling alone, and for whom what we have to offer has not been enough. It hasn't been the right things. So I'm going to be doing some talks soon, and hopefully you can connect with those too, specifically about sort of how to sort of talk about how doing more of what we have been doing is not sufficient. We're going to make a difference for those people out there today, tomorrow. We've got to be really doing these different things that you're advocating for, and some of the things that I think your listeners will hopefully buy into and take to the next level.
Awesome. Well, I am so, so grateful for our friendship, for your leadership. You inspire me all the time, Eduardo. as you do many, many people around the world. So for the show notes, for the links to the resources, please go to my website, .com, or you can find this podcast and all the others on iTunes. Please leave a rating and review. This is how iTunes helps people find this podcast. And periodically, I'll do a drawing for an Amazon gift card. So do that. Also, sign up for my newsletter. We've got Twitter chats, webinars, blogs. In closing, open your heart, challenge your thinking, and take action steps to save lives. Together, we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living. Take care. Bye.
You're listening to Love Advice with Leanne. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Leanne. Longtime listener, first-time caller. Why, in your professional opinion, do you never take my calls off the air?
Is this Carl?
Yep, it's Carl. I mean, we had a few dates. Everything was great, I thought.
Well, you know, when you switch to GEICO, you could save a lot of money on car insurance.
Okay, awesome.
You should call them.
I will.
GEICO, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.